Well, we all know the nation values the public land in Alaska, but what about Alaska? Anwar is 50 years old December 6th. What will Anwar be like 50 years in the future? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Regardless of how you feel about oil and gas leasing near the coast, there are another 17.5 million acres beyond the disputed area. What about that? Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk@aprn.org. Are we undervaluing our public lands? The subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The Federal Aviation Administration sets rules for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, and when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message is sponsored by the FAA.
Okay, so to set the scene, if you go back 50 years, you see the closing days of the Eisenhower administration. You see the election having already taken place, and John Kennedy has defeated Richard Nixon. There will be a Democratic administration in Washington. And you see Secretary of the Interior, Fred Seaton, who probably we would not have had a statehood act without, decides to name the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to set it aside. That's 8.9 million acres. Since then, it's been expanded to 19.2. There had been a campaign, particularly by the Wilderness Society, to get this National Wildlife Refuge designated. At the time, however, it was called a National Wildlife Range. So now we come to the 50th anniversary, and the Fish and Wildlife Service is going to have the presentation of a play. It has an exhibit of photographs, and the agriculture secretary, I think it was agriculture, one of the federal dignitaries, various federal dignitaries have been through and no doubt will be through to commemorate this anniversary. And how did it get set aside? Well, basically, it was the only place left. It's up there in the corner, and there hadn't been much ever happened there. And so the thinking was, if there's going to be some place, a big hunk of the Arctic that can be just left alone, this is it, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So they did. So we want to talk a little bit about this place. And look at it through the eyes of the people who have experienced it and are working on this idea and this commemoration. I want to first welcome Gloria Baxter to the microphones. She is a playwright. She is responsible for the production Wild Legacy, which is being done by Living Voices, Voices of the South, that's it. And she joins us by telephone from Memphis. Gloria, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And basically, as I understand it, Wild Legacy is going to take us, is about to be presented on the stage in Memphis, like within days.
This Friday we open, yes.
And it is going to essentially, the style of the theater is a presentation of the thinking of mostly Margaret Murray, right?
Yes, we're actually using the actual prose text of Marty Murray's from Two in the Far North, and then we bring all the values of theater to her written voice with imagery and music, but we're trying to capture Marty's special kind of exuberance about her visit there.
Well, now, as I understand it, Two in the Far North was actually written based on their 1924 trip. And she is the first woman to graduate from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
Yes, that's true.
And she just graduated, and she marries this federal biology guy, Aulus Murray.
Uh-huh.
I mean, she's already in Alaska. She marries this Olaus Murie. He's from where? I think Minnesota or something like that.
Minnesota originally, but he had been working in the Arctic for several years already when they met.
Right, and of course he has his famous brother, who's the wolf biologist, who will become famous later on for that.
And his brother, very particularly Adolf Murie, for the wolf work in Denali, too.
Yes.
So here's
these newlyweds, and they decide to go up into this empty part of the country.
Yes.
Essentially, they go to, as I remember it, they go to Wiseman.
Yes, I think so. They actually are in very remote areas, but stopping at roadhouses. They travel about quite a few miles, about 550, I think, mm-hmm. by dog sled.
Yeah. And so we have this 1924 trip, but it is really not until some years later when the Muries once again make a trip into the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Yes, and that's in 1956.
And this is deliberately, they have people like Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas is their guest, and all sorts of now famous environmentalists are their guests on this camping trip. And what they're essentially doing is they are promoting this idea of creating this wildlife range, right?
Yes. And I know one of the things that appeals to me so much is that the way they were promoting it was in large part through the arts, because they were taking photographs, making slides, making a film, planning to come back and publish articles in magazines, and it was just trying to raise awareness and appreciation for what the place that so few people had seen was actually like.
Now, Gloria, you've actually been there, and we're going to bring in at this point your guide
yes.
for your trip.
Yes.
who's one of the proprietors of Arctic Treks. Mm-hmm. It's Carol Kazza of Fairbanks. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. It's great to be part of this, and especially with Gloria.
Yeah, and you got to take Gloria in some years ago, right? 2001 was it?
Yeah, it was 2001, and it was actually a custom trip we did for the Murie Center, which was formed in Jackson to carry on the legacy of the Muries, and so this was their first trip they had put together to bring supporters and members of their organization, members of the board of directors up to see the Sinjek River, which is where what you were just talking about, where the Muries had done that trip, they spent several months there. So it was the first time I had actually been on the Sinjek. We'd been, this is our 32nd year of this summer of leading trips in the Brooks Range in the Arctic, but that was the first time I'd been on the Sinjek. So it was just a wonderful experience for me to discover that valley and share it with these people from the Murie Center, people like Gloria.
And I want to go back to that, but I just briefly with a little bit of background, Carol. You've gotten politically active. Yeah, I mean, you're clearly pretty passionate about this part of the country.
Absolutely.
You've headed, probably had to do with the founding of the Wilderness Guides outfit.
And I got involved from the beginning with the Alaska Wilderness Guides Association, and then we started an organization, the Alaska Wilderness Recreation Tourism Association, which was really focusing on these big land use decisions and redefining tourism as not a service industry, but an industry that's based on natural resources, and the natural resources we depend on are wild lands, wild places, wild waters.
Now, it's not going to be any news to you, I'm sure. In fact, you've heard it until you're really sick of hearing it, but one of the most common criticisms of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and wilderness status for it, and indeed 8 million of these 19.2 million are already protected under wilderness designation, but that leaves a bunch more, and that's under discussion right now. People say, well, look, this is this really in the national interest? It's only a very small elite that is ever going to go there, and it is an elite. I know that that's not the way that the people who conceived of the place think of it. They have never really thought of it as a place where only the elite go. They thought of it rather as a place that's just really hard to get to.
Yeah. Yeah, I was actually thinking about that this morning. Because I've heard that argument so many times, and it's what we've done as humans, all of the beautiful, wild places that mean so much to us in nature, the ones that are left intact are the ones that are remote, because we tend to take over and turn those wild places into something else. So it's just more of a function of what we do as people that the places that are special end up far away.
Yeah, and the federal management will tend to do this thing. Like, some of the most interesting lands in the West are not, I mean, national parks can be interesting, but there's vast tracts of the West that are just incredibly beautiful and remote country that are run by the Bureau of Land Management that are maybe used for grazing or something, and they're essentially not managed. They're just left alone. And that's really kind of been the management approach to much of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, hasn't it? I mean, it's not as if you really, when you're guiding your trips in there, you're not exactly going to see, like, rangers and so forth coming around to make sure that people, distribute the stones from their campfire properly and so forth.
Yeah, that's, to me, one of the things that makes it so remarkable is to have that experience of just being out in a truly wild place, you know, unlike my husband and I just did a trip on the Colorado River, a three-week trip a couple of years ago with our guides and some friends, and again, that's incredible, spectacular, beautiful country there, and the experience is really fun and interesting, but it's very heavily managed, so the place isn't destroyed, but it's such a different experience being in a managed setting like that compared to something that's just absolutely really, really wild country.
Yeah. I was hiking through country in wilderness in Vermont, of all places. And, it's like, wow. So all of a sudden you go across this boundary and you see that, nobody uses chainsaws in here. It's kind of stuff like that. But I would think that, I mean, when you're doing your trips, Carol, you're probably very much into this, the leave no trace and all that. I mean, not only is it sort of required when you go into wilderness, but just in terms of because that's the nature of this piece of land.
Yeah, and that's really immensely important to us, because we're wanting to keep the land as we experience it when we go there.
Well, Gloria Baxter, the playwright of Wild Legacy, on your trip in 2001, maybe you can take yourself back to that time and give us a little bit of a feeling for what in you changed as it set in that you were really in the middle of nowhere here.
I was just thinking, listening to you and Carol talk, I remember how I felt on the plane to go there. I have traveled a great deal in my life. I've lived in Europe a couple of years and traveled a lot in national park areas. But the kind of anticipation I had for just what Carol is talking about, I went, this is something I know nothing about. It's probably only going to happen to me once in my life. And I was expecting a kind of experience that I just knew was rare. And when I got there, it really was. I think even though we were in a group of 12 with Carol, and our camaraderie and Carol with us made it a lovely human community in the evenings, the idea that you can only go in with a small party like that was very important to me, because the sense of silence and the vastness that I was looking at, I think I found myself thinking so much about my place as a human being, because you really sense that you are on a planet when you're seeing how our Earth is without any of the marks of us there, not trails or roads or signs or lots of motors going over my head. I think it was one of the most deeply meditative periods. I've continued to write about it, actually, for the next 10 years, just a re-entering of time, being with time in a very different way, coming from an urban life to there.
Do you feel that the way that you did your treatment of Wild Legacy was, you know, was informed by that personal experience that you had?
And indeed, that's one of the reasons I went. I had told the Muri story about their lives in Wyoming, and that's one reason I have been in love with going to Wyoming so many years, because of their books. But as I read the way they talked about this place and the depth of passion and lifetime commitment they both had to it, to continue to make sure it was going to still be untouched, was just very moving to me, and I needed to find out about that other place too. But the book really led me there too, in the Far North, that I read very early. And since then, I've got a whole library here of Alaska books. But that was an inspiration because of the two people kind of personalizing for me why they loved it as much as they did.
Now, I know this is going to be, this is actually an impossible exercise, but trying to picture Anwar 50 years from now.
Yeah.
Is it sort of what I've tried to assign our listeners. And it's not so much in the sense of predictions as it is, let's say that it remains as it is, mm-hmm. How will we value it? How will it be seen as it's part of the world, it's part of the planet, 50 years from now, when, let's say, there's a bunch of shipping in the Arctic Ocean, let's say. When the distribution of warm and cold on the planet is different than it is today, when there will be things that will happen in terms of the certainly animal and probably plant species by that time, where there'll be all sorts of invasive stuff, and they'll have to make tough decisions about managing what really is wilderness and so forth, and whether anything should be done as an invasive, whatever bugs and, things that come in as time goes on. What kind of things can you picture in 50 years in this place that you visited?
Well, for one thing, just listening to all those descriptions then, I'm thinking again of Olus and how much he said to have a place where I can actually watch processes of change. Even alien things that come in, if it's new grasses or changes in the wildlife, that there's a place where I can actually see the process that the earth, how it works. And there's just so few places left with that kind of intact ability to watch over time how the earth is unfolding itself. I'm thinking what's going to be valued. I thought about your question, and for some reason I've been really thinking, because I'm surrounded by college students a great deal of the time, I'm looking at the current moment that we're living in, when virtual reality seems to almost be preferred over sensory reality, whether reality shows are not actually reality, and everything is a new kind of way of experiencing. And I just think being able to have a place left is going to be of even more value in 50 years, where you sense your sensory being and your ability to have some kind of actual relationship with your sensory experiential life in a very unique way. I think that's going to be a large value as time, if it continues to develop as we're watching now.
Yeah, well, that is very thoughtful. I'm glad you've taken some time to think about that one. You can get a little feel for that sort of sensory impact you're talking about if you've dwelled in a place of silence, and then you like when you're hiking, sometimes you can get off into some remote place and you really hear nothing but birds, and your own footsteps get to be kind of loud, And then you approach a town and you realize, holy mackerel, I can hear this town 3 miles away.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So, I'm so glad that Gloria is expressing all this so beautifully, because this is what we see over and over again with the people who come on our trips in the Arctic. It has this kind of profound effect on them. And most of them just can't put it into these beautiful, eloquent words that Gloria has so in such a lovely way. But that's truly the effect that a wilderness like this has on people.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're Carol Kazza, you're in the business. You're running visitors into there. If you were to look ahead 50 years, do you see your business surviving, thriving? Do you see maybe there comes a time when visitation has to be limited? I guess in some ways it already is limited in the sense that you need to travel in small groups and so forth. But let's say, for instance, that there's not much ice in the Arctic Ocean and there's some kind of port, say, in Barter Island or someplace. It could be a lot of visitor pressure coming in.
Yeah, and again, we sort of live in two worlds. The one that Gloria expressed so beautifully, that's how we experience the place and is so meaningful to us. And then because we are a business there, we're having to deal with all these land management decisions and thinking about how things are going to change in the ways you just said. And I think, you know, change has been coming there. It's only going to continue to come. So my hope and vision is that we'll learn from everything we've done other places that's worked or not worked and come up with better ways to manage it thoughtfully in a way that protects that quality of the experience as much as we can. And then, yeah, and I don't know how that's going to go or not. Yeah. You know, we say we've been at this for a really long time, so I don't know, and there's so many changes. But I think about a lot is what Gloria said about the young people who live in these virtual realities, and what I don't know what that's going to do to us as humans if we can't feel, like as you put so well, Gloria, that feel our sensory connection to place and what that means, who we are as humans in that way. And so,
well,
to me,
I think it is. In a lot of ways, there's a sort of a delayed adolescence that goes on nowadays. You know, I notice in the Appalachian Trail hikers that the young people who get on the trail, that once they discover these capabilities in themselves, they get kind of drunk on it. They get kind of carried away with it because they hadn't really known they were capable of all these things. And I think back to last week's show, we did a show on Native youth suicide, and the character, the primary character in the book is a boy who goes suicidal and who is basically sucked up into video games. And I guess one element of this situation is that the playwright realized that the mythology that was perpetrated in the video games actually would help prepare this child for a hero's role. In other words, the mythology was still moving through the video game. That's the way it was used dramatically in that play. I thought that was really interesting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That does sound.
Yeah. It's you know, it's basically your basic hero myth, which, you know, we now know is sort of shows up everywhere. So it's kind of interesting that way. So
yeah.
It always cuts both ways. Let's try a few phone calls. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. We haven't touched on it, but essentially the Fish and Wildlife Service is undergoing a planning process for the Arctic Refuge at 50 right now. And that includes examining more wilderness designations. One area that's being thought about is the part of it that extends over to the Dalton Highway, which, of course, now people can drive to. And there's really been no change in the management of that, but maybe there should be. That's one of many. There's the business of aircraft overflights, many, many other things. And, of course, the coastal plain. And it is from the coastal plain that Robert joins us from Kaktovik now. Robert, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you.
So how are you doing?
Really good. I have some concerns about the next 50 years in the Arctic Refuge.
I would think. Well, please, go ahead.
Okay, I come at this a little different perspective. This is my home. I've lived here for years. I look out and I see it every day. And our people in Upiat have lived here for thousands of years. So my concern is to keep it like it is for future generations. I'm looking beyond 50 years, maybe 1,000 years. I mean, all our future generations. I've enjoyed it throughout my life, and I'd like my I now have great-grandchildren, and I'd like them to enjoy it also. And when I look at this and I see it's risen to the national level in presidential elections and so on, and I say this is only 5% of what the oil industry has available on our North Slope. So I think if people can realize that, we've got to save a little bit. It's only 5%, so I don't think it's too much to ask to save this for all future generations. I was out in Minnesota, and they have an area, Boundary Waters, 1.5 million acres, and they saw fit to save it years ago, and now people enjoy it. So I think that would be, you know, what we could look at for the future, that this last 5% should be saved.
All right, Robert, thank you. Eloquent from Kektovik. Thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Jim, joins the program from Eagle River. Can we switch over to line 4? I know you got dancing on the phone patches there, Dave. Let's go to Jim in Eagle River. Thank you, Robert, again. Hi, Jim. You're on Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. I wanted to pass on something Ken Kesey said when he was presented with the argument that so few people would ever go to Anwar and the Coastal Refuge. He said, "I may never go to the Library of Congress, but I sure am glad it's there."
Thank you, Jim.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess it is. Carol Cassidy, you would probably say, yes, it's an encyclopedia.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the source to me. It's literally our model for wholeness and completeness. So if we lose that, it's gone. We can't replicate that as humans. We need to have a source there that we can go to.
Yeah. Well, I want to take you back to this this guide question that I was asking you, because I sense that you sort of don't want to look you don't look at it. You have been guiding there for, what did you say, upwards of 30 years?
Yeah, 32 years this summer.
And, I mean, you know, to add 50 to that probably is, I couldn't do that if I were in your position. But still, if you look back, that huge span of years, you've already seen a bunch of things change. I mean, for instance, I know I was talking to your partner, and he was saying, yeah, we do more river trips than we used to. We used to be more hikers, but our clients now are more, they're older, which is sort of ominous.
Yeah. Well, things do change, you know, and and that's a good thing, you know. Life goes on, and to me, you say we're not going to literally be here 50 years from now leading trips, but I hope that there's these opportunities available, and I hope that, I think we're just going through a huge period of change right now, and I hope, and my wish is that, and hope is that these wild intact lands can remain, and they will change as they do, as Gloria put so well. You know, the Muries knew that. They were scientists and researchers. You know, they observed nature, and so things will change. But we're going to be here as humans and establish ourselves in a different kind of relationship with the earth, is my wish.
Yeah, well, you know, my wife got back from New Zealand a few years ago, and she was very attracted to New Zealand for a number of reasons. And when she came back, she said, it's just so depressing ecologically, because here's a place where they didn't have mammals and where birds evolved to fill all the niches that are occupied by mammals in most of the rest of the world. And in order to even preserve these birds, they have to use all this poison. In other words, there's active management going on there. I can foresee a time when there would be a dispute, and probably not too far in the future, about active management in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for the same reasons, because of invasive species and so forth. Anybody got a thought?
That's so interesting. I guess the only most immediate thing I can think of is what a large controversy it's been, for instance, in the national parks like Yellowstone, of should you let fires burn, it's going to change it, you know, for a very long time. But that we didn't understand at the beginning what purpose the fires had, right? So I'm trying to think if there's anything similar about that.
Well, I don't think that you can exactly stop bugs on the border or something like that.
Yeah, you know, my experience and knowledge about places where humans feel like they have to step in and manage to maintain something, it's one of the key factors that always comes back to habitat. And when you lose habitat, and that means large, vast tracts of it, not little pockets, because nature lives in a very vast tracts, not little pockets, then that's when humans feel like they have to step in and, you know, replace this or replicate that. But and so if we want to have something remain natural, the key is to have as large a tracts of land as we can kept in their natural state.
Okay, but so I guess I would say that there might be a point then where your clients, as a guide, your clients would be required to whatever go through some kind of a process to make sure they weren't carrying any seeds in for invasive species. And we're seeing these around road corridors and around trails now, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the vegetation is changing there already. I mean, I think there's, you know, the climate is changing and the vegetation is changing. We've thought about that, you know, just what that, you know, looking out there in the future, you know, what kind of clothes we're going to have to bring, you know, what the climate's going to do. So, I mean, things are going to change. And to me, there's some of it that's just, you know, the world goes through changes like that. And
yeah.
What we can be conscious of as humans to not contribute negative impacts to it.
All right. Well, thank you both of us, both of you. As I'm talking to Carol Kaza, a wilderness guide from Fairbanks, and Gloria Baxter, who's a playwright of Wild Legacy, which is about to open to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the formation of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. So it was like just right after statehood. And then it was before the Wilderness Act. And we'll get back into this walk through geography and walk through history as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications available at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is December 1st, 2010. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association.
Well, folks, it very definitely is not the rainforest, but it's got its own ecological charm. It is the Arctic. It is a big hunk of the Arctic upon which nothing has happened and is being managed in such a way that not much will happen. It's the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. You know, we were talking with Carol Kaza and Gloria Baxter. We were talking about the forces of change over the next 50 years ecologically, as well as other ways. And, you know, I'm thinking maybe at 19.2 million acres, it's actually the kind of laboratory that can sit and show us adaptation. It can show us, we can learn through seeing how it responds to change. And Carol, you've said it's already changing.
Yeah, dramatically. Yeah.
Yeah,
the rivers change, the vegetation's changing, weather changes.
Yeah. So maybe it will fulfill that function that the Muries were thinking of when they were kind of marketing the idea of the Arctic Refuge, which is that it really will have a growing scientific value just by being left alone.
Mm-hmm. I read, it was in Roger Kay's book, I read it a few days ago, but he was saying Brian Kessel, who was one of the young people at the time and became a leading ornithologist in Alaska,
She was one of the first people to say this is a place that can be a referent point for how she had early on mentioned climate change, for instance. You can understand, as a scientist, by looking there, what has and hasn't changed over time in terms of climate. So at least we have a reference point for without our manipulation, what can we find out there?
Yeah. Can you tell me, Carol, if you're seeing that thermokarst problem that we're seeing elsewhere in Alaska, where these kind of sinkholes are showing up because of permafrost underneath is...
Oh, yeah, dramatically. There's a number of areas that where we've run trips where you'll see it, the most dramatic signs on the hillsides where the whole big... you know, tracts of tundra have just let loose and these big landslides come down. There's always, you know, along the riverbanks, you know, there'll be cave-ins and such, but it's just increasing. We're seeing more signs of it, it seems.
So you get bears and wolves, I guess,
yeah,
when you're out there.
Yeah, that's what part of it that's wonderful is all the animals and birds that are there.
And what do you tell your clients in terms of managing for the bears?
You mean what we do personally?
Yeah. I know what one would do, say, in Denali, where they give you a can to put your food in. I don't know. Do you use those?
Yeah, and we just, what we talk to our clients a lot about is just how to pay attention and be aware of what their surroundings, you know, just watch. We just try to convey to them that this is the place, the animal's home where they live, where the visitor's passing through, so we're trying not to, you know, impinge on them, but also to keep ourselves, you know, and operate in a safe way. So we just do a lot of talking about the sort of the ecosystem and the animals, and paying attention is the most important thing.
And there's just sort of this thing of thinking like the bear, you know, where is the bear going to be? Which way is the wind going? And how are they smelling? And what corridor are they likely to be using? And where's the cub likely to be? Where's the berries? And so forth.
Yeah, and then how to understand their behavior, you know, and what and interpret that.
Yeah. Let's go to Joseph, joins our program from Petersburg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Joseph.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Thank you very much for taking the call, and excellent program, and appreciate all the commentary by both your guests and their wide experience in the ANWR there. A few years ago, there two people followed the caribou herd, and the name of this documentary was called Being Caribou, and usually it's in public libraries. People can check it out, and they kind of documented the importance of the Arctic coastal plain. And it's difficult to have this conversation and try to separate the Arctic plain from the rest of the refuge, because that's where the next biggest political battles are going to take place to dictate the future there. The other thing, I don't think the greater public, especially outside of Alaska, really understands how industrialized by the oil industry the north coast of Alaska's Arctic is. It's kind of mind-boggling for people to discover, actually see pictures of it, you know, windswept in the winter and all the lights and towers associated, pipelines associated with the industry. But, you know, there's this huge political myth that unless we can develop the coastal plain, modern society is doomed. And I would like the guests to address that myth and how we can overcome that and make the wildest wildlife and wilderness aspects of the coastal plain greater for the public that's out there trying to interact with this political debate.
All right, Joseph, I think we have a pretty good idea where they stand already, and I have not brought in people from the industry to discuss that because that's not really where I wanted to go with this discussion. But nonetheless, I think it's fair for you to hear where they stand on the issue of the coastal plain, and it probably won't be a surprise to any of us. Let's start with you, Gloria Baxter. I'm sure you're acquainted with the 1002 dispute. We know there's oil there. The industry says it can be environmentally responsible in recovering it. And of course, this is also habitat for caribou, especially for insect relief. And we know the differential behavior, the males and females, and so forth. Where do you come down on this? How does it feel to you that really needs the wilderness needs to have some of the coast in it too to really be the thing that it's intended to be?
I do agree, yes, that the coastal plain needs to remain a part of the refuge. I guess I saw the piece he's talking about, the Being Caribou, the documentary, and just the sense of, aren't the calving grounds are very close to there? Am I confused about that?
Well, they're way upland, but the deal is they're kind of in between. There's the insect relief issue, and there's a predator of, large mammal predator issue in terms of when you get into the more brushy areas. They vary as to where the calving takes place, and there's all sorts of intense factual dispute about if there really is a core calving area and so forth.
I know, I was just thinking as he was speaking, since I've been directing this play for the last few weeks, about every choice we make, I am always saying, what do we gain and what do we lose with this choice, right? And I guess I feel that what we would gain by changing the status of the coastal plain is very short term, and what we would lose is very long term. A lot to do with the man who called earlier about concern for future generations. It makes me think, I'm totally in sympathy, Terry Timbus Williams, you may know her poem where she writes about this subject and just says restraint is the virtue that we're called to have right now. We don't need every single, modern society will not collapse without it. So I have pretty strong feelings there.
Okay, Joseph, you got that answer. Now let's turn to Carol Kazza. You're probably following the planning process.
Oh, yeah, and we've been involved with this issue for years, trying to protect the coastal plain because for a number of reasons. The primary one is that the refuge was set aside as to protect the whole intact ecosystems from north to south. That's what's so remarkable about that area, because the mountains curve up so close to the coast. You have all these different ecosystems that are in this one unit. And so, to take out one part of it, that's literally the heart of it in so many ways, it destroys the whole purpose of, setting that aside to start with. And then there's the pure practical side, as the caller was saying, there's a lot of misinformation out there that, by the figures I've read, just by efficiencies alone, we could, save as much oil as at the highest speculations there are in the coastal plain. And this last summer, I was on a custom trip where we were at the mouth of the Colville Delta, and we were picked up in a beaver and were flown from there across the whole North Slope to Kaktovik. And that was the first time I had seen the whole extent of the oil fields and the development that the previous caller described. And it was absolutely shocking to me. I mean, I knew it was there. I'd been to Dead Horse. I'd, seen it on maps, mapped out. But just to actually see it from a small plane, the whole extent was just staggering to me. And by the end of it, as we got over to the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge, my son was with me, our 24-year-old son, too, who grew up with us doing trips up there. And we were both just in tears, because all I could think of was that overlay of this mass industrial development on that beautiful, intact coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge. And that would just be the biggest tragedy to me.
Yeah. Well, of course, they say they would do it differently. It wouldn't be the same kind of footprint, as we know. And probably I'll let it sit there for now. From Fran in Fairbanks, a note from 52 years ago, and this is how good a sales job that the Muries did. 52 years ago, 2 years before the original Arctic National Wildlife Range was established, a Fairbanks Daily News minor editorial, March 7th, 1958, entitled "Where Are the Mines?" criticized the state mining commissioner for opposing creation of the range. The editorial stated, "The News Miner has already announced its position on the proposed Arctic Wildlife Range, as has the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. We are strongly in favor of it." And the editorial went on to explain at least part of why they supported the range, because the Secretary of Interior revealed that as part of his action to create the range, he also was opening 20 million of acres on the North Slope to oil and gas prospecting. And mm-hmm. guess where that turned out to be? Mm-hmm. Prudhoe Bay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she goes on to call that a compromise that everyone's forgotten, which is a pretty interesting historical note, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's really important to remember that. Yeah.
Let's go to Mary, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mary.
Good morning. Thank you for having this wonderful conversation. I visited the Arctic Refuge in the early 70s. I was a volunteer assistant guide. And it was an experience that changed my life forever. Now I'm in my mid-60s and probably won't get back there, but just knowing that wild space is there on this planet gives me great comfort and peace. It seems the world is crazy now, and sometimes you just have to ignore it to survive, but knowing that wild place is there is really worth keeping it that way forever.
So in a sense, you're kind of saying this just like what Gloria says. Look, in a way, it's still with me. I'm still writing about it. Yeah.
And my generation has taken so much from this planet. I think this is a precious gift we can leave for future human beings to experience it, even if they don't go there in person, if they see it through other people's eyes and photographs and words and movies and plays and poems. I think it will be a source of healing for of people that really needs healing these days.
Yeah.
I think that's a much higher purpose value for that land than trying to develop it for a short-term quick fix for energy problems.
I like your use of the word healing there.
Well, I think it is. Wilderness is the salvation for the human race, I believe.
Thank you, Mary.
I'm so glad to hear that those words, because that's exactly what my husband and I feel personally, what the Arctic wilderness has done for us and what we see the effect on the people who go there.
Let's go to Mark, joins the program from Juneau. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mark.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me on again. And I should preface things a little bit. I used to be a journalist and wrote for, among other things, Popular Science for 10 years as a bit of a futurist. And when I was in the military, and even now, people have used me as, I've got one of those ENTP personalities that can kind of see things, you can sort of patch things together a little more than some other folks. And I'm afraid that you and your guests and your listeners probably don't like the vision that I have of 2060.
Well, let us have it, though.
Well, here it is, you know, that we live in a world that is driven by human beings, and we know human beings to be pretty greedy and rapacious animals. Our current world is one that has 6.7 billion people. In 50 years, are we going to be looking at a 10 billion person world, a 12 billion person world, a 14 billion person world, all of them wanting these resources? That the resources that we have here, America and North America, is going to fight hard for. So you can see Alaska becoming more of a bastion of power and sort of a fortress mentality. The Arctic Ocean will become a playground for the Chinese aircraft carriers as well as ours, and the Russians and the NATO navies and the Brits. And I wouldn't be at all too surprised to see this to be a real future area of conflict in many ways. And particularly, it's going to be a grab as quickly as possible, because there's only three grabs left on the planet until we find whatever the next system of energy is and all that, or we die. And, you know, number one is the ocean. That's the one we're working at right now. Number two is the Arctic. And then, of course, there's Antarctica at the very end. And if people want to talk to me about, you know, treaties and all these things, well, that's not going to matter in a world with so many people that need so much. And in order for governments to maintain the tiniest hold on whatever they still have, they're going to go nuts. You're going to see a scale of industrialization in some places like Blade Runner or Avatar. It's not going to be everywhere, but you're going to see places where there are things to take out. And we're talking primarily hydrocarbons and, you know, methane up here. Probably gigantic production extraction factories, you know, not even no longer, you know, pipelines and transmission lines are ridiculous. technology. So you'll be dealing with probably un-ice reinforced giant cargo ships to take liquefied natural gas and oil. And they may be even consuming the power at the place and beaming it into space off a satellite and shooting it where they need to go.
Oh, but Mark, you're giving me a headache.
It's ugly. It's ugly. It really is. You thought the dew line was a big push that we went. We are going to go all nuts again up there. And the Chinese are pushing this. The Russians are pushing it. I hate to use this term on the morning show. It's going to be a huge pissing match. And unfortunately, all these treasures, and I've been in Anwar, been all over the North Slope there. You think that our Navy, when it starts running out of power, is not going to use the Naval Petroleum Reserve? You know, look at these things. You can all see this coming to a singularity of sorts, and it's a negative singularity. And it's either if we stop having babies now and change our lives completely, we can change this, but just the brakes are off this thing, and I really don't see a good ending at all, unfortunately.
Mark, I look forward to your next call. It's always going to be challenging. Thank you so much for your call. It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking about the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge the next 50 years as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Richard Nelson, anthropologist and host of Encounters, is coming to Anchorage as part of the Alaska News Fund Speakers Series, bringing public broadcasting faces to Alaska. Richard Nelson will be in Anchorage at the Anchorage Museum Auditorium on Friday, November 12th. For ticket information, go to aprn.org or call 550-8400. Proceeds will benefit APRN Alaska News Fund.
Trying to look ahead 50 years to what the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is likely to be then, and we just heard a pretty grim vision there. I thought maybe we'd see if we have some responses from our two panelists. Let's start with you, Carol Kaza.
Well, that was interesting, and I guess, like he said, he spends a lot of time thinking big picture, and I was realizing spending a lot of time out in wilderness gives me an opportunity to do that. My nature is that too, so I think about these things a lot too. But I guess from a different perspective, when you contemplate from a place of wholeness, you end up with different kinds of projections, I realized. And to me, that's one scenario if we continue on the human path we've been on. But I guess I'm not a fatalist in that way. I think we are at a real turning point, and we need to make some different choices, but I guess I still have faith that as humans we're going to use our creativity in more productive, different ways. You know, going back to the trying to get the oil out of the petroleum reserve, we've moved past the oil economy here. We're moving into whole different realms of how we live as human beings here on the earth. So I think there's going to be a lot of things happening, but I can see a whole different kind of picture than the one he painted.
All right, before I go to you, Gloria Baxter, I'll give you a second to think about it, which always you do some really good thinking, so I'm looking forward to what you have to say, but I want to pass on this one from Dan, who got in touch with us by email, and you may even have seen this, Carol. He says, I've heard that when they shoot those rockets from Poker Flat, sometimes the remains end up in Anwar. Have you ever seen rocket pieces?
No, haven't. That would be really interesting, though, to find, but we haven't.
Yeah. It would be, wouldn't it? But nonetheless, that does sort of violate the wilderness, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Let's go to Gloria now. We heard Mark, basically, who is a technology specialist and a bit of a futurist, saying, there's just no hope of preserving this. This is going to go industrial no matter what. How does that, what kind of future do you see? Do you see an alternative to the Blade Runner scenario?
I guess as I was listening, because actually I do have, I can have dystopian visions too. And I guess what's been interesting me just trying to look at big picture lately is it just seems there's such an well, I guess every age feels that, but there is some interesting dialectic of two different kind of things going on right now. I think of, on the one hand, you hear in the youth culture, multicultural is what the planet is trying to become, where we are all interactive in some kind of way. And then at the same time, almost as a resistance, like all over the world, not just in certain pockets, I'm seeing the tendency to want to re-tribalize and to be sure we just keep the boundaries the way they were, right? In that culture, there's a force there. I feel it likewise in watching, I called the last 30 years in America the last grab, right? And somehow, watching now that in the recession, people trying to make simplicity a desired virtue again, rather than something that has befallen us, right, as we've come away from material. And of course, I'm thinking of this all so much because the Muries were in exactly this kind of period. It was post-World War II. They had seen what an atomic bomb could portend. And their response was to have another vision of what could happen. So I guess I'm watching I've taught the history of theater for a lot of years, and just watching how influenced those people, when they came under fire from atomic bombs, from what was happening with how rapidly America was beginning to take the tops off our mountains and turn everything into asphalt deserts, their vision kind of went back to the transcendentalist, you know, where there was another kind of sense of values. So I've spent my last few months steeped in the notion of non-material values that Olaf had. And one of the things they did was show people it can be done, that it is not impossible to make shifts in zeitgeist like that. They stayed with it and stayed with it, and they got it to happen. And you would have thought then, too, that it was impossible.
Mm, very good. I want to give Carol Kaza a chance, too, here, and we only got a minute left. So, Carol, yeah, that strikes me, what Gloria said, the takeaway of sort of the when the going gets tough, the tough get going, and what the Muries did to respond to the bomb and that existential crisis that everybody was having back then, was to have this dream that we're talking about now. And maybe there's dreams being dreamed right now.
That's what I see. And that's what I look to the young people to just to connect, to carry us through. I don't think they're going to live in a world like the one guy described. I think they're going to make different choices. That's where I place my hope.
Hmm. Do you see your company surviving? Are you going to pass it on to the
Yeah, we have a group of wonderful young guides who work with us, who care as passionately as we do. They want to keep it going. So that's where I see the hope for the future, and people who care. And we're of the earth, literally. You know, we're connected, whether we try to pretend we aren't or not. So I think that's what ultimately drives us and will bring us back again to our home.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us. Gloria Baxter, who wrote Wild Legacy. Your play will be opening in Alaska shortly in Fairbanks, and we'll get that information up on our website. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Carol Kaza, thank you, too.
Thank you.
Okay, next week on Talk of Alaska, well, I'm not sure about Tuesday. We're trying to get together one on bullying, but I know next Thursday is Ted Stevens Day, and we're going to be part of the celebration, including you. Thanks to Dave Waldron and Pat Yak and BD Trentina. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.